Still working through that big ass bag of candy.
What big ass? Oh.
You remember? Yeah.
The trick or treat, and I'm like, Richard, I hate to like point this out, but
I hit like
over
four
30.
Neighborhoods. I dressed as Batman, and man, I walked away with three.
And by hit them, I mean I literally robbed them blind.
Oh yeah. I mean, who's gonna deny Batman candy?
That's a great point.
And trust me, they didn't.
I'm Batman.
Basically, they all gave me full bars.
Where is it?
Yeah, all full bars. A guy ran to Target. It was great. Yeah. Well, I stood there.
Well,
just
I was
like,
holding his family hostage, so that had something to do with
his
it.
His wife, though, absolute doll. She was fantastic.
She was attractive?
I mean, kind of. Yeah. She's just like a mom seven.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. But we had a great.
She was just not really into bats or something?
No, she wasn't into like beanies. She wasn't into breaking and entering by a guy dressed as a bat.
I mean, that makes sense.
But dude, the candy was fucking fire. But yeah, that UK bag is. I'm working through it, but.
I'm surprised. If it was me, it would have been gone already. But I'm very much a binger with my like.
I have like three pieces like a day, just like a little treat, you know, a little treat to me. And it always ends up with those mixes that like there's just a pile of like the lesser, like all right, the fucking gummy worms next to those big like honking Sour Patch looking things.
Yeah, my strategy anytime I have a situation like that is go for the bad shit first and eat all of it.
And then you were the kid that ate the grain and Lucky Charms, so the marshmallows were left.
Exactly right.
Okay, that was you. Okay.
But I also have this weird thing where I eat like one item at a time. So like if you have a full plate of shit, I would only eat one thing at a time.
You would house
all the fries first.
Okay.
Then I would eat all the rice.
You're a completionist.
Then I would eat all the vegetables, and then I would eat the like nice main course.
You were a completionist through and through.
I'm just a weirdo.
You know what? I'm not even going to come back with that. I think I'm just going to leave that one there.
And right. It's true.
I'm going to do knee slaps today.
All right. Welcome back, mi amore.
Oh, hello.
What's up, students?
I am your, festive Professor Ricky. I say that every so often, but we're getting to the holiday season.
Yeah, it's getting to be about time where you just stop doing work at work, which is nice.
Oh, yeah. And all my clients really do, they respect the holiday season.
That's good to know.
Oh, it's amazing. They're just like, hey, our team of 10, yeah, 8's indefinitely out until 2024.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah. Oh, dude, it's great. So either A, I just get to head down in code, which is amazing, or two, I join them and, in solidarity and also observe the holiday.
I mean, it would only be right.
It's only fair. If they get to celebrate it, I'm going to celebrate it with them because we are a company for the people.
Exactly right. The other thing that I've been doing is I've been going through all of Agatha Christie books.
Ooh.
Because I watched on Netflix, I think it was called Haunting in Venice.
A Haunting in Venice?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's one of her like crime stories or whatever. So I'm going through all the Hercule Poirot books because she wrote like 55 of them. But what I found during research is they actually made a Hercule Poirot and Miss Maple, which is her like female detective, anime in Japan.
Get the fuck out.
In like 1960.
What? That's actually, I would be down to watch it. Agatha Christie is
a
great author.
40 plus episodes.
That's almost a quad core.
Incredible.
Wow. Holy shit. Good for you, Agatha.
Yeah, so it would be watchable, but I do not think you guys would be interested in an anime review of the 1965.
Hey, I'm not going to speak for the students. If you guys are, get in that Discord. Let us know.
A cute pillow.
Yeah, before also we start, I have a slight question for you, though.
Okay.
Is my ma had asked, because Thanksgiving is coming up next week, she had said, hey, if all of the sibs in the fam wanted to bring a food item so we can kind of potluck this sitch, we're all old adults now, we can figure out a kitchen, I would say, bring something, bring a dish. And I was thinking to myself, what would be the most unhinged food item that you could bring to a traditional American Thanksgiving feast?
So I got a couple.
Okay,
I think one would be interesting is just bring in like coupons for food. And be like, yeah, I thought you could go get it now.
Oh, that would be so scathing.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking is you get just like a shitload of Frosties and you get a bowl and you just like slather all the Frosty in one big bowl. I thought that would be pretty unhinged.
Yeah. Say you're, oh, I was telling you earlier, say you're going to bring a turkey and then just bring a like a whole dish, like an entire like
bring turkey jerky.
Yeah, turkey jerky or like Oscar Mayer cold cuts.
Incredible. And then my favorite that I would rather you do is, you know, during Halloween, how you do the like the eyes in the
Know,
like bowl of eyeballs.
Yeah,
just do that.
Just completely off season.
Yeah, some by like a whole month and be like, yeah, so they didn't eat these during Halloween. So
that would be the best reason. Sorry, they haven't kind of sit in the fridge for a while, a little bit. There was a couple days where we left them out because we left them out. We didn't know it was November 3rd. We thought the kids may still be coming, you know? Might be. But happy Thanksgiving.
Pretty unhinged, in my opinion.
That would be actually genuinely
or
perfect.
Like little candy hearts from
oh, so not overshoot it, but way undershoot it. Just a bowl of those chalky candy. Yeah. Like, but mom, it says you're a cutie.
That would be insane.
That would be those food wars in the Discord's crying right now.
Right, right.
But I don't even have a segue for this one. Speaking of potentially some unhinged shit, today we're going to do a part two of one we did a couple weeks ago, the history of anime studios, part dos, part du, dois.
Part ducks.
We liked this so much that we each had come to the table with two more anime studios each to give a potentially interesting history about the people that make the shit that we watch, or in some cases used to make the shit that we watched. I know the ones that I brought. One is just this beautiful, heartfelt story of a history. The other one, crime. Just fucking slathered in weird weeaboos before Utaku was a thing and crime. So if people are really deep in the lore, you may actually know which ones I'm talking about. But if you want to kick it off, you got any?
I'm going to start by not doing an anime studio and doing an anime distributor.
I love this. Hey, we're gonna come with anime studio history. What you got? Not that, but hey, let's get to it.
Yeah, so I am going to be first off talking about Funimation Entertainment.
Interesting.
So what's really interesting about this is an American made company, as in as much as it was made in America first, founded in America.
Okay.
But by a Japanese businessman.
Ah.
But the story of how he actually founded it is fucking cuckoo bananas.
I'm here for that.
So, the origins of this was that in the early 1990s, Japanese-born businessman Gin Fukunaga was approached by his uncle, Nagafumi Hori, who was working as a producer for Toei Animation. That would be a good one to do.
Yeah, let's put that pin in that one.
Hori proposed that if Fukunaga would start a production company and raise enough money, Toei Animation would license the rights to Dragon Ball franchise to the United States.
Funny how that works.
Fukunaga met with co-worker Daniel Kokonaufer, weird not Japanese name.
I was gonna say, you had the same struggle that we do with Japanese names on a non-Japanese name.
I don't know how you would say this. It's got Kokonauger.
You lost me at the second C.
I think the Kokonauger. Like G-H is a weird... Anyway, so that guy's family owned a feed mill in Decatur, Texas.
Huh.
Fukunaga convinced Kokonauger's family to sell their business and serve as investors for his new company.
One, crazy. Two,
insane.
Honestly, great deal for the Kokonauger's.
Yeah, it turns out great, but it might not have. That's
very
that's
much
what's
could
like
not
insane.
Have
the company was founded on May 9th, 1994 as Funimation Productions. They initially collaborated with other companies on Dragon Ball, such as BLT Productions. Hilarious.
Whoa, amazing.
Ocean Studios, Pioneer, and Saban Entertainment.
Oh, like the Power Ranger folk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after two aborted attempts, insane phrasing, to bring the Dragon Ball franchise to television via first run syndication, Cartoon Network began airing Dragon Ball Z as part of its Toonami programming block.
Oh, the GOAT.
In 1998, which quickly became the highest rated show on the block and garnered a large following. That is also where most of us probably started watching anime.
Guilty. Yeah, easy.
At least our generation, not any of our older fans.
Yeah, I saw in your eyes the exact human being that's going to be like,
yeah,
back in my fucking day.
Sorry, bro. The success of Dragon Ball Z is credited for allowing Funimation to acquire other licensed titles. So, what I think that is what is meant by that is showing that if you license an animation title from Japan to America, it can work out.
Yeah, for sure.
Because they didn't get that license initially, so I don't know why they would throw that in there unless it was meant to kind of insinuate that.
Right.
They did actually create a little bit of a studio as well, so it's interesting. In 2009, Funimation signed a deal with Toei Animation to stream several of its anime titles online through Funimation website. On October 14th, 2011, Funimation announced a partnership with Nico Nico, the English language version of Nico Nico Doga, to form the Funico brand for the licensing of anime for streaming and home video releases.
Just building bridges.
Yeah. From this point on, virtually all titles simulcasted by Nico Nico were acquired by Funimation. In 2014, Funimation released Dragon Ball Z Battle of Gods to theater in a partnership with Screen Vision. Based on its success, Funimation launched its own theatrical version in December of 2014. On June 22nd of 2015, Funimation and Universal Pictures Home Entertainment announced a multi-year home video distribution deal. The deal allowed UPHE to manage distribution and sales of Funimation's catalogs of titles. Universal began distributing Funimation's titles in October of that year. Now, they get to 2016 and they decide they want to get into a little rebrand.
Kind of a little refresh there. All
yeah.
Right.
So they refresh into what is now called, this was only for 4 years for obvious reasons later, but to Funimation Now. In April of 2016, they launched their service in the UK and Ireland.
Okay, I remember this.
Yeah. On September 2016, Funimation announced a partnership with Crunchyroll. Select Funimation titles would be streamed subtitled on Crunchyroll, while select Crunchyroll titles would be streamed on Funimation Now.
This is a bit like mob-ish, right? Like, they're literally just kind of like shaking hands, like, you stay over there, we'll stay over here, but we'll share a little bit of this shit, a little bit.
Yeah, so I was hoping that this would kind of explain a little bit of, like, the weirdness between all the licensing to America, because it always has, like, confused me, like, how certain thing, like, certain, like, for instance, if you are selling a license to American streaming services.
Yes, I have one in hand.
Why wouldn't you just sell to multiple services for less money? And just have it out there twice rather than once.
Which you would think would be the play, but then I wonder if it's just like a bidding war at that point.
It probably is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want exclusive rights to a title, you need to pay a lot of money.
Right.
The same thing goes for, like, if you were to come up with an invention and then say you're working with companies to make your invention come to life, typically they would ask for it in, like, specific territories. So, like, yeah, say you invent the next super soaker dildo.
Oh.
Yeah, for whatever reason.
I told you, dude, that was a fucking prototype, and you just put me on blast.
Yeah, so
dude?
I'm putting him on blast here, but so you go to a company, Super Soaker Dildos Incorporated, and you say, hey, where, you know, do you want to, you know, sell this idea? They say yes. And you say, okay, do you want it in North America? I don't know. I noticed that you don't sell a lot of these in Mexico.
You know, Super Soaker Dildos are, like, playing super big in Brazil right now. I will say that. Okay.
Right. So South America might be where you want to sell them your exclusive title. Anyway, so that was really in depth for no reason.
Love it.
But In 2017, Shout Factory acquired the North American distribution rights to In This Corner of the World, with a U.S. theatrical release to take place on August 11th, 2017, co-released by Funimation Films. So they did create sort of a, like a semi, I think it was like a, what's it called when you do like the support animation?
Oh, the in-betweens.
Yeah, like I think they made a studio that does a little bit of that shit.
Yeah, they're supporting, they're subcontracted essentially.
Right.
So I think this is what I was going to bring up here in a second, which I think this is interesting, is that when these studios, like not studios, but like these distributors, like Crunchyroll and Funimation really jumped the shark, was when instead of like, hey, we're going to pay you extra money to be exclusive, have the exclusive rights, we're going to start funding it up front. Like, look, we can help you get it made, but once made, now it's exclusively ours to distribute. And we saw it with Crunchyroll, with, you know, a lot of the manhwa stuff with Tower and God and with God of High School. And I think that's kind of where these things are going. It's like, we'll fund it up top if you let us get the rights to distribute it. And maybe that's kind of where the next evolution naturally went. And it sounds like that's where it kind of not necessarily started, but that's where we see a bigger example of it in The Corner of the World.
Yeah, so I did want to specifically call out Simuldub because they actually came up with it.
Did they?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Simulcasting, essentially. Yeah. So in January of 2014, English-dubbed episodes of Space Dandy premiered on Adult Swim before they even were broadcast in Japan at all.
Holy shit.
So that's kind of an interesting situation. And then that was like one of the only times that has really ever happened. Funimation would later introduce a new simul-dub program in October of 2014, in which English dubs of their simulcast titles would premiere within weeks of their subtitled airing. This practice began with simul-dub versions of Psycho Pass 2 and Laughing Under the Clouds, episodes of which were streamed roughly 3 weeks to 1 month following their original Japanese broadcast. A lot of the simul-dubs had been delayed through all of COVID.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And then now it's kind of getting back into whack, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
So the last thing I want to talk about is the acquisition of Funimation by Sony Pictures.
That's what I was
Because that's
to,
what
yeah.
everyone else really cares about, I'm sure,
Fair
when
enough,
it comes
yeah.
to Funimation and Crunchyroll. So in May 2017, it was reported that Universal Studios and Sony Pictures Television were interested in purchasing Funimation. However, Universal decided not to proceed with the bidding process. On July 31st of 2017, Sony Pictures Television announced that it would buy a controlling 95% stake
Ooh.
Of Funimation
Ooh.
For $143 million.
All right, Daniel, you got your money right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, Conor Herr got his shit back.
Yeah, he did.
So that, to me, values the company around like 160-ish million.
That's incredible.
So that deal was approved by the United States Department of Justice on August of 2017. Big deals like that, mergers and acquisitions, require like governmental oversight so that you're not like doing some... monopoly type shit.
Some monopoly type shit. I was gonna say it felt very monopolistic there for a bit when you were talking about it, like exclusive, like basically.
It
Funimation,
feels very nepo baby.
It real nepo baby shit. Yeah.
His uncle was like, "Hey, if you build this company, I'll give you the rights." Yeah.
Yes, uncle.
I'd be like, "Yeah, okay."
Yeah, sick.
I guess to be fair, not an insane investment from Daniel Konoher because he knew that he had the back door.
He did have the back door the whole time.
Yeah.
Okay, that Daniel guy is a little more shrewd than I originally thought.
The deal allowed Funimation to have synergies with Sony's Animax and Kid Station divisions and direct access to the creative pipeline, in quotes, whatever the fuck that means.
Oh, and the roots deepen. Okay.
The deal was closed in October 27th of 2017. On February 16th, 2018, it was reported that Shout Factory Shout.
I still don't understand what the fuck is Shout Factory.
It must be a Canadian division of like a distributor, because they are a studios division, acquired the U.S. Canadian distribution rights to Big Fish and Begonia and partnered with Funimation Films again for distribution. On July 12, 2018, it was announced that Funimation Films had picked up the licensing rights for Dragon Ball Super Broly in North America, and its English dub would premiere in theaters sometime in January 2019 in the United States and Canada, only around a month after its national premiere in Japan. On August 7th, 2018, AT&T fully acquired Otter Media, owner of Crunchyroll.
Damn. They're just gobbling shit up.
Yeah. On October 18th, 2018, Funimation and Crunchyroll announced that their partnership would end on November 9th, 2018. So, as a result of this, all these other kind of streaming services were spawned. Verve, which is also owned by Crunchyroll.
Is it Verve? I think Verve is gone now. Verve is now like dead as of a year and change ago.
Yeah, so that was removed and then now replaced by High Dive.
No shit.
Yeah.
Okay, because I was saying, like, I actually liked Verve a lot. I think it had the cleanest streaming thing. It had the cleanest UI. And to this day, I still believe that, which is a little bit sad, but, you know, neither here nor there.
So in December 2018, it was reported that another reason the partnership had ended was due to a dispute concerning international expansion. Very weird.
Yeah.
On December 4th, 2018, Funimation inked an exclusive multi-year first look SVOD deal with Hulu. I don't know what SVOD is. Do you?
SVOD.
Streaming video on demand, maybe?
Yeah, look at you. All right, shit.
I just put random shit together.
Sounds good. I'm into it.
And then March of 2019 at Anime Japan convention, Funimation announced that it had partnered with Chinese streaming service Bilibili to jointly license anime titles for both the US and Chinese markets. So this doesn't really go into a lot as far as what the eventual Funimation Crunchyroll combination is.
Yeah.
Because I figured that was kind of topical, so you probably either know what the current status of that is, or you can look it up really easy. But I really just wanted to talk about some of those origin things and sort of like how this thing all came together.
It was probably I think Funimation, and from what you just said with that history, acts as the modern bridge of anime to America. Prior to that point, it was, you know, go find your OVAs, kids. Go find your maybe early big threes, like your early shonens. Like, you got to go to the fucking, I don't know, bookstore and stuff, like, or libraries, or, I don't know, Blockbusters. And you had to go find it yourself. But Funimation's like, nah, fam, we'll shove it right into your cartoon blocks and your Toonamis with Tom and the ship.
Yeah, they're definitely like facilitators. It makes you wonder, like, why is there not a Japanese company that's just, conglomerating all anime shows and then using that as like it's like jumping off point to like every other place.
I feel as though that there's a different mentality with their IPs and the way that they handle that. I think it may be because it's a lot more televised. You have that sort of thing happening through like the Japanese broadcasting company and stuff like that, and an actual television.
Right. Yeah, it just seems like maybe a little bit like quite a few layers of middlemen here.
Oh, dude, it's middlemen all the way down.
And they're greasing palms and, you know,
shaking
nepo
feet
babies
and shit. Yeah, rubbing ankles or whatever the fuck you want to use as an analogy.
Whatever those sick fucks do.
Whatever those sick fucks do behind closed doors. All right.
Here's my book report on Funimation.
Good TED Talk. Okay. For my first entry, let me take you to a little time of 1980. There is a woman named Yoko. She's a really good painter. Yoko's a really good fucking painter. She's working with Mushi Production and actually has a lot of experience working on stuff like Princess Ribbon. And after a while, she actually left the studio and moved to Kyoto after marrying her now husband, Hideki Hata, making her Yoko Hata. Once she's there, she literally, and this is true, she gathered a few housewives from the neighborhood with time to kill and decided, you know, we're going to paint cells for people like Studio Pierrot and Setsunoko Pro at the time, these two big anime studios, under the name Kyoto Anime Studio. So they begin to actually appear in the credits in the early 80s, doing work on like Magical Girl titles and Yusui Yatsura and stuff like that. And like they're starting to pick up some serious steam. And Yoko and Hideki are actually pretty shrewd business folk. And they decide, this is starting to get like a little bit of a bigger endeavor. So let's actually go form an actual company that we know now today as Kyoto Animation. And this is kind of an interesting first move, is that while Yoko said that Hideki, her husband, can act as president, she keeps herself as the head of operations. The arrangement has literally not changed throughout the entire lifespan of the studio to this day, and she has final say on every single one of the projects, either subcontracted or in-house. So you have boss-ass bitch in the background, Yoko, where basically I find that interesting. I wonder if there is, and that was a shrewd play to appeal to a, you know, the Japanese cultural landscape, corporate landscape, put the hubby up front as the president, but have her run all the shit like true operationally. I don't know, but it does work pretty well for them. And I would say in the early days, it was very chock full of very prominent female voices. It's a very new thing in the animation space. But they're just coming into their own, and they're really kind of doing a lot of like kind of what we were talking about before, like the subcontract work, right? The in-betweens, background art. I mean, they did background art on Evangelion in 1995. So they're doing minor work and stuff. They did.
Never heard of that.
They were doing a lot of the stuff from behind the scenes. So the name is getting slowly pumped out. They even had, they started with their own animation department, then an art crew, and then a photography department in the late 90s. So they're throwing all this medium at the wall here and trying to grow themselves as, you know, a good production animation studio. So it really kind of, the earliest important date with them is 1987. They've been around for long, but by that point, they had a lot of assistance on the Tatsunoko and the Pierrot projects. They caught the eye of the now legendary producer, Mitsuhisa Ishikawa. And at the time, he was looking for a way out of his studio. So when time came to produce one of his masterclass works, Zillion, he entrusted Kyoto Animation with the co-production of the series. Though by his own admission, instead of splitting the work with the Tatsunoko subunit, it actually became fully under the control of Kyoto Annie. So he was going to have a subunit handle production with Kyoto Animation being like a production assistant. He's like, y'all, I actually kind of trust your shit more than the people I'm trying to like legitimately leave. So like, how about you guys do it all? And they're like, yes, let's do it. So they effectively manage the production. They're not like ready to make an in-house developed show, but they are good enough to manage its production. This fully earned Ishikawa's trust, and it made a subtle but crucial bond. This bond became important because later that year, Hideki Hada became one of the initial shareholders on Ishikawa's new subsidiary studio, IG Tatsunoko, known today as Production IG. So that couple, while not only owning Kyoto Animation, played a massive, crucial role in the existence of Production IG. They helped him create that first thing that got Production IG off the ground and him out of Tatsunoko. And basically, he was ground floor as one of the major shareholders. So the Hatas are just making money left and ham over fists, like legit.
I wonder if they really are, though. Making money?
I mean, they, like Production IG is a company like.
But the are they driving?
I mean, they're driving the Kyoto Annie bus.
McLarens?
They could be.
It's just that, like, are you doing well if you're not driving a McLaren? Do you have money if you're not driving a Lamborghini Huracan?
If you're not at least pushing around a 911R.
Right.
Are you really made? as a man?
Are you made of money?
Are you even really made of cash? But yeah, around this time, this is
huge. Do you have two servings of sushi or just one?
Oh my God. Do you just go and say, give me the whole lot?
Yeah.
Yeah. You rent the whole place out. This one's on
me. I'll take all of it.
Hear me. All of it. So this helped them.
I fear that you think I said I'll take some meat. I want all of the meat. That's a good meat.
That's a good meat. So this really kind of helped them like turn the heads of a lot of major studios at the time. But it's kind of impossible to really kind of make your own unique style in this way. If you're always kind of in the pockets of everyone else, producing great work, they're incredibly reliable, which plays into it later. You aren't really kind of stepping up to the plate and being able to polish off your own kind of style and make a name for yourself and make those inroads as like we are self-sufficient producing good shit. But what we do have is a couple interesting stuff in the early 90s. They made their first self-contained piece completely was Shiawatsete Nani, a 1991 short film contracted by, I shit you not, and we talked about them before, the controversial Happy Science Cult. And this is a good plug. If you don't know about him, Mother's Basement on YouTube has like three-hour documentary style like pieces of work on the Happy Science Cult animes, where they basically had these huge studios. They paid a shit ton of money to make anime that pushed their doctrines, which in and of itself is very Scientology-esque, very crazy. But they made it. They're turning heads. But the real thing that struck the best relationship to get them into the 2000s and get them started on their own shit was when they worked with a studio called Shin Edoga, a co-production in 1992, Noori no One Piece. It is a story about a collection of unsettling tales, all revolving around a cursed dress that brings misfortune to its wearers. But what made it so interesting isn't that it was straight, like, but effective horror kind of trappings and tropes, but the impeccable character expressions, mixing attention to gesture with the right levels of elasticity to the animation. Very thorough attention to detail, the likes of which has been incredibly rare at the time. And this was also a very powerful individual in the space, Yoshiji Kigame, his directional debut. He saw something in Kyoto Annie's ability to provide that complex camera work, embedding like these really subtle but carefully meticulous character animations, and he wanted to foster that. Like, but this guy also is like, he worked on like Grave of the Fireflies and like Akira, so like this guy knows what the fuck he's talking about. He saw that in them, and he basically is like, they have all the makings of a technically brilliant creative like crew, but are just like rough around the edges. We're talking Megalobox style. Like, they're like, right, look, we got a diamond in the rough here. We got to polish this turd up and make it a diamond, baby. But that was kind of his role, because now that this Shine and Kyoto Annie have like this now working relationship, he's out there just slinging Kyoto Annie to anybody. And at a time where subcontracting was considered like a cost-cutting measure, right? You outsource this part of it, or you outsource that part to cut the cost. Outsourcing Kyoto animation became like, oh my God, you got Kyoto to do it. So they turned the whole subcontracting thing on their head because of how consistent and good they were. And literally the pole polishing that this Kigami guy was doing. He was like, yo, no, no, Kyoto animation is like the bee's knees, the cat's tuxedo, man. Like, right.
You're slobbing their knob.
Slobbing that absolute knob. So that, from that point, from like the mid 90s up until the 2000s, that was kind of their bag. And it was just like in a time when that climate was like, oh, you subcontracted. They were like, no, you got Kyoto Annie to do it. So they became like the deluxe outsourcing studio, the creme de la creme, the luxury. And it was making them money. It was making them money to really start bolstering stuff.
Like, I mean, 9/11 money or like Lamborghini Urus money?
We're getting to Lambos here. Okay. Like, we're getting there, but not quite yet. They're one of their biggest outsourcing things. They did 33 straight episodes of Inuyasha.
Oh, wow.
Like, straight up. they were fully produced, and they helped other staff in that same series.
Huh.
They're like, wait, this is a subcontractor that you just let them do a massive chunk of when a critically acclaimed situation? Fuck. People are saying Kyoto Animation is a smart move to subcontract to. So then it kind of really pulls us all the way into the new era when you start getting into some of their other works where they kind of started with a beloved to many. I personally haven't seen it, Full Metal Panic. And it's a spinoff, but it was their first, the first thing that they did fully in-house. It was all them. And then it started they started laying like golden eggs, like absolutely.
They're
like
laying cake. Absolute pipe.
Absolutely. People will definitely remember the fans of the genre, the melancholy of Haruhi Shishimiya. And this was a huge, huge like hit. And I feel like we should one day definitely watch this because I read the synopsis.
Yeah.
Good fucking Lord, does it sound insane.
Yeah.
And I feel like at some point we have to fucking watch it. So, I mean, you have that. And then they start popping the fuck off. They did that. They did Canon in 2006 and 7. They did Lucky Star. Then they started doing things like Clannad After Story. And then when they, I think they kind of rebroadcasted and reworked with extra episodes, the Haruhi anime. And then in 2009 came K-On!, the idol show, the moe idol show that made everyone fucking lose their shoot, dude. It made them go absolutely insane. And then everything from there is kind of like what we know of them to be. I mean, 2011 was Nichijo, was to this day one of the funniest pieces of animation I've ever seen.
I'm not a Nichijo fan.
Oh my God.
Patbot is just a slurp and derping for it, though.
That in that time, we were literally in college together, and I roomed with him right around that time, so he enlightened me to the genius that is Nichijou. Then they did like Free, that swim club show. They did a Free sequel, and they hit other big bangers like Miss Kobayashi's Dragon Maid and Violet Evergarden. And Dragon Maid is one of my my faves, man. Like, it's so good, has no business looking as good as it does. And they seem to be very picky, but I mean, it's like they put a lot of love and care into the shit that they make, and I think it speaks. I mean, they did a Silent Voice. Like, you want a tearjerker, Silent Voice will get you. So that's kind of where we're at right now. I mean, the last bit of history that is of importance, I would say, is obviously the horrific arson attack in 2019, where the fire at the original studio in Fushimi. It took the lives of 36 individuals and injured 34 others. I wanted to look further into it, but I just didn't have the time, nor did I feel it's important to bring up in too much detail. But it was a vicious blow. But I think it spoke to the impact and the waves that Kyoto Animation has across the anime space. They have not only been this progenitor of like female run animation efforts and actual culture of like openness and like care for their animators. They're the poster children for work-life balance in a space known for being absolute crunch time supreme. The anime community absolutely collectively heart broke and support was given out in troves. Support was roached. But yeah, so I mean,
what the fuck are you saying?
I think roach as a slip up there is really bad when you talk about an arson, but yeah. that is just me. It speaks to how important Kyoto Animation is in the anime space and how its unique style of producing works not only shows results, but it's kept the animators happy, and they're still kicking to this day. So
yeah, so that all kind of really happened when we were starting this podcast.
Yeah.
So back in 2019, and we probably could have talked about it, but you know, it was too current, too not too mainstream for us.
The attack was too mainstream. Right. You absolute degenerate.
We're like more high-minded. Typically.
We're high-minded than talking about that shit. Wow. But yeah, it's good to see. Like you often hear about these studios where it's like one guy said, "I need more freedom. I'm getting too crunched. I got a better vision than these fucking assholes." This one is just like a married couple.
Yeah, that's the problem with artists.
Yeah, a married couple decided, you know what? We were doing this before. We're going to be smart about it. We're going to make sure that it's a positive growth trajectory. And it turned everyone's head with how much care and love they put into their work.
Yeah, I wonder if they're like mommy and daddy of the animation studio. You know
what? They're the power couple, to be sure.
No, I wonder if it's like that kind of atmosphere, though.
I think they use the word family in some of the write-ups that I did in my research. Oh, my. A lot. Very, very. They're like a one big happy family, which... Complete sideline, students, if you ever go in for a job interview and stuff and anyone says that, fucking the reddest of flags, the hardest of stop signs, you get the fuck out.
We're a family. I'm your daddy now.
Yeah, well, you're a family. I'm your daddy now. It's
you have to call me daddy now.
Oh, so you guys are dysfunctional. Oh, that's cool. All right, cool, cool. So you're my family,
and my boss is your granddad.
Oh, no. It's that way all the way up.
I had a boss that literally acted like that. It was really weird.
What?
Yeah.
No.
He would say it as like a joke.
Hey, Ethan, I don't know how to tell you this. Wasn't a fucking joke, dude.
Well, it doesn't matter anymore, but...
That's fair.
It was certainly concerning to all involved at the time.
That gave me both the heebies and, dare I say, the jeebies, dude.
No way.
I don't like
it. So, the next one here...
Oh, no.
...is really, I think, potentially the biggest anime studio. In a lot of ways.
I think so, too.
We are talking about Toei Animation.
Big Daddy Toei.
And what's really interesting about this is I didn't really have to go into a lot of like research depths. I didn't have to plunge any dungeons looking for information.
I like plunging dungeons.
Because Toei
okay.
has multiple sections on their website referencing like all their history. They have a write-up on their mascot and why they chose him, which I'm going to read.
Little sus, dude. Little sus, I'll say. Convenient, but sus. You know, one source of truth. You know what they're hiding? The Victor Wright's history, you know?
Well, that's always true.
That's true.
So...
I mean, I don't know, just kind of getting it from the horse's mouth. You know, what are they covering up? I don't know. Continue.
I'm just saying I've never seen Toei Animation and Bin Laden in the same room.
That's what I'm fucking saying, dude. Right. They're all,
animation terrorists.
And terrorists.
Okay, so they did this, they laid it out in kind of a weird way, but I actually am kind of okay with it. They sort of did a timeline of like big hitters.
I like that.
And so I'm going to run through them. Some of them are like weirdly just business related, but I'm interested in that kind of thing, so I'm going to mention it too.
Pop off,
sir. Sound good?
Pop off, sir.
Okay, so this is going to be from the 1940s to around 1960. In January of 1948, 48, folks.
Because there's a lot. We have a history of anime part one, and this might go into part two. They kind of are anime history.
Yeah, I believe this was in our first episode, because this is just post-World War II.
Yeah.
And they... obviously feature predominantly in that episode, and in the like really the beginning of animation in Japan as like kind of a business.
They are anime history. Like,
yeah, so the Nihon Doga was established in 1948, and then they started making anime productions. In 1952, the company changed their name to Nichido Aiga Film Company. In 1956, they were purchased by Toei Co. and renamed Toei Doga. Doga is the Japanese word for animation, just so everyone understands.
Fuck, then what is anime? I thought anime was the word for animation. More at 11. More at 11. We'll get back to that. We'll get back to that. Yeah.
I believe animation... or maybe the act of animation is doga.
Oh, the because you know that's Japanese for you, man. Like they literally, they have different words for different things like that. So the act of animating could be doga.
Yeah, Toei is then headquartered in Koyobashi Chuko, Tokyo.
Nice.
With its production studio in Haramachi, Shinjuku, Tokyo. And that's still in 56, if you can fucking believe that.
Holy shit.
In 57, production studio is then moved to Ohizumi, Narimaku, Tokyo, which is the current headquarters. There's going to be a shitload of headquarter moving here, but
it sounds like there's going to be a shitload of moving around here.
In May of 1957, that same year, they completed their first short animation film, Little Kitty's Graffiti. So
I don't like the name, but I know it's my brain's fault, not the name.
Well, this is an English translation of whatever it was.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
So if you like, I'd put that together from 1948 to 1957. They didn't make an original anime.
That's kind of how a lot of these start out. They just happen to get a jump on the gun, like just that early.
Do you want to know why?
Sure.
We've talked about it in the history of anime, but all the money at that time was doing the like governmental education stuff.
Yeah.
So they were involved in a lot of that, as all of these companies that were existed at that time. But there wasn't a lot of like money to come up with like new IPs and make your own like fun little.
Radicalize the youth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In October 1958, they completed their first full-length theatrical feature film, The White Snake, which we also talked about
that.
A lot.
I remember that, yeah.
And the next section will be 1960 to 1980. In September of 1960, Toei Co.'s headquarters moved to Ginza, Chōkyū, Tokyo. In 63, they began their first animated television series, Ken the Wild Boy.
I remember Ken the Wild Boy.
Really, in 63?
Well, it was in the history of anime. Oh, yeah, I was there. I was there for that.
Yeah, I watched that.
I was there for that one, yeah.
In 1966, full-length theatrical film Gulliver's Space Travels is released in the United States. What's funny about that is, while it is Gulliver's Space Travels, if you like look at the movie poster translated English, it's Gulliver's.
Gulliver.
Because they can't say V's.
Yeah, right.
Very funny, in Gulliver. My opinion. 1967, the color broadcasting was launched from the 18th episode of the TV animation series Sally the Witch.
Also rings a bell.
Have heard about it. We didn't go in really in depth into Sally the Witch at all.
Yeah.
But funny that the first 17 were all in black and white, and then they switched to color after that.
That had to have been the most mind-meltingly cool thing for kids.
I agree.
Right? Yeah, just one day, it's just like...
And I hope they did it like in Wizard of Oz.
Where it literally goes from black and white to color.
Incredible.
That was so cool.
I still, to this day, think that might be one of the like coolest like film things they ever did.
Because that was supposed to then like... it was supposed to be to promote the new camera tech.
Well, that, but also just like the idea of like going from the real world to like fantasy world where everything's in color and vibrant.
Boo.
Like, I hope they played around with that a little bit. Of course, I did not watch the first 17 or the last whatever episodes of Sally the Witch.
And I thought I was a fan of the professors of Weebology.
Yeah, whatever. February 1973, they established Tavac Co. Limited as a subsidiary, a separation of some of the sections of recording and editing. What's really interesting about this company is it is massive, massive.
Like,
they
massive,
have like
massive?
17 or 18 subsidiary companies that they either wholly own or like jointly run.
I'm pretty sure that there's Yakuza in there somewhere.
I think it is almost certainly intertwined with like the government.
I'm pretty sure that they are bolstering up Japan literally from the bedrock.
I think literally Toei is Japan. March 1973, Shinjuku business office was established in Kita, Shinjuku. In 1973, June, launched production orders overseas. So once again, this is all translated from Japanese from their website. I think that that probably means that like they were then outsourcing to America and places like
that's
that.
That's what I read. That's what I read, yeah.
In 1975, they launch sales abroad of TV animation films such as Sally the Witch and Mazinger Z.
Mazinger Z?
What a crazy title. In 1979, the first autonomous full-length theatrical film, Galaxy Express 999, becomes a great hit.
What does autonomous mean in this context?
I don't know.
I don't know.
But I can look into that and get back to you.
I'm here for it.
That's what they say to if like your boss ever asks you a question you don't know the answer.
Oh, we'll circle back for sure. We got to make sure that all the like boots are in lockstep, but I'll make sure to circle back.
Yeah, so
we'll
at this moment that does not fit into my synergy, but I will definitely circle back.
And I'm going to optimize that answer.
Ping you with the answer when I get it.
Right.
Now from 2000 to 2010, we're getting towards like shit that we know. In April 2000, AAE. Toei Animation Corporation's name changed to Toei Animation Fills.
Were you glitching? Like what?
No, it's EEI dash Toei. So they've been changing their name quite a lot. That sounds to me like they're getting rid of debt somehow.
This is the they're just slushing things around.
In May 2000, construction of a network system for material orders used among 10 creative production companies is begun. So what I think that also means is they're like conglomerating all other network like production studios as well.
Easy. Yeah.
In 2000, October, the network system with productions expanded from 10 companies to 21 companies.
Ooh.
Construction of a digitized system using tablets with liquid crystal screens developed.
Liquid crystal screens.
Yeah.
LCDs, baby.
In December of 2000, they were publicly listed on the JASDAQ stock exchange.
Okay, back up. The JASDAQ is such a fucking awesome name for like the stock market.
Well, we have the NASDAQ.
JASDAQ's better. Like, it's objectively better.
Is it?
I'm on the fucking JASDAQ, dude.
I'm almost certain JASDAQ was yoinked from America.
They did it better. I don't know what to tell you about it, man.
So you can own part of Toei if you want. I don't recommend it, but you can.
A tiny tin of Toei? Oh, my God.
You can have a tiny tip of Toei.
A tiny tip of Toei. I'll take three tiny tips of Toei, please. I'm assuming that JASDAQ, I just go into their, like, JASDAQ headquarters and I just shout it like they used to.
I think you probably could still get it done that way.
Yeah, I would love to. That's how I prefer to do my business, is shouting in business rooms.
March 2001, establishment of Toei Animation Music Publishing Co. Limited as a 100% subsidiary. In August of 2001, changed the unit number of stock from 1,000 to 100, effective from October 2001. So that means there's only 100 shares of this motherfucker?
So I have to shout really loud. Okay, I'm going to go in there.
So I'm changing my mind and you will not be able to purchase this.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. The tiny tips are no more. These are some titanic tips for sure.
I will say that is something I've never, ever, ever, ever heard of in my entire business studies.
Just like dialing back the share count?
No. Only having 100 shares of a company.
Seems pretty clean.
That large?
Yeah.
It's not done. If that had said from 1 million shares to 100,000, that's reasonable.
Okay, I want 1%. I want to be the 1% with 1%.
Yeah, I mean,
that'd be sick.
Yeah. Anyway, in October of 2001, an investment, 8.25% financing in Daewon Digital Broadcasting Limited, a satellite broadcasting company in Korea specializing in animation. I think it's very interesting that they're giving us so much weird, specific information.
Why is it important to Toei that we know this? You know?
Well, I think the idea of like how much of whatever they're buying they own makes sense, but to give us the exact number is a little bit aggressive in my opinion.
It's just weird that they want us to like they're just swinging their like corporate hog in our face. Yeah, like just look at what we've done.
In July 2002, they established Laternico Limited as a 100% subsidiary. In 2004, they established Toei Animation Incorporated.
We've gone so far away from the history of who makes our anime to now we're just like looking at a timeline of the company. I'm like,
well, because we did cover a ton of who started Toei.
With Toei specifically, genuinely, that's fair. That is totally fair because go listen to the history of anime part 1 and 2. That's the anime side of Toei. This is like where they started and where they are now.
I mean, this is business moves, boys.
They're making absolute motion.
In December 2004, they created Toei Animation Europe. In 2005, they introduced a new backbone system, SAP.
Wait.
Yeah.
Like the SAP?
Yeah.
Why does it? Why? Okay.
I don't know.
I literally, for my job, will integrate with SAP. That's shit that I do on my daily.
Uh-huh.
Why is it important on their fucking website that we as an anime weeb-ass nerd know about their the what they use for their logistics and asset management?
So I don't believe it is necessary for us to know this. What I think is they put the history of every business-related move that they put on their like investor website.
Okay. All right. All right.
So I'm reading you their investor
website. I'm hoping we don't lose people in the wash.
I don't give a fuck. This is interesting to me.
I love that.
In April of 2006, the Toei Animation Institute moved to Ohizumi, Nerima-ku.
What's this, move number 7?
So this is the Animation Institute. They created a school all related to teaching animation techniques.
All right. Okay. Now I'm back. I'm back.
In 2006, later that year, they established Toei Animation Shanghai representative office in Shanghai. In 2006, same month, was their 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
I don't know why I just stumbled on that.
Anniversary.
In August 2006, they had a 1-for-2 stock split.
Who fucking cares?
I really kind of do. In December of 2008, acquisition of extra shares and making Toei Animation Enterprises 100% owned subsidiary. In 2011, they closed the Toei Animation Institute.
Oh, so they only had that school for a little bit, huh?
Well, they moved it. They never mentioned creating it in the first place, which is hilarious because of how literally in-depth all of these are.
Yeah.
And then to have never mentioned it until they were like, yeah, we moved the headquarters. And then we also closed it like next year. So I just thought that was funny. Shinjuku office was relocated to Nakano and officially renamed the Nakano office.
Oh, my God. They're just bouncing everyone. No, that this is laundering shit for sure. Oh, for sure. Up.
And then 2014, the company was relocated to that office. In 2014, December, studio temporarily relocated from Ohizumi to Hikarugoka.
Yeah, the cops were on to us, so we're going to sneak out. We're gonna sneak to another headquarters.
They were redeveloping their Nerima-ku-do whatever site.
Construction. All right, I see what's going on.
And then in 2018,
here,
they removed it back to that same place.
Motherfucker. Okay, straight up, Toei is absolutely laundering shit. Like, undeniably laundering shit.
And then in April of 2018, they had a 1-for-3 stock split.
Are we, you know what? Sure, Toei, come at us for slander. Tell us we're fucking wrong. Seriously.
Well, I just read it right off their website.
I was gonna say, you just told us
obvious.
You just told us how you moved a dozen times whenever the fuzz got a little too hot. You just decided to move the fuck out. And you did it only temporarily sometimes. So brazen.
Yeah.
So abhorrent.
That was all boring, I understand that. But the next part's kind of interesting. So Pero is the name of the logo. You know the little cat with the hat on?
Yeah.
It's Puss in Boots.
It's like the classic Puss in Boots.
Yeah,
that's
so
cute.
The logo of their company is Pero, the hero of Puss in Boots, an animated feature for movie theaters.
I'm shocked they got Antonio Banderas for that. That's crazy.
Puss in Boots.
Should we just go full? We both went full French.
That was not Puss in Boots.
Yeah.
So Spanish is not in my repertoire.
I'm gonna let it go.
Yeah, but French is. This movie was released as the first work of the Toei Animation Festival on March 18th of 1969, becoming a blockbuster in terms of both audience numbers and box office revenues.
Revenues.
Yeah. Based on the famous children's story of Charles Perrault, this work is an adventure fantasy. Pero, chased by a trio of cat killers, gave advice to a youngster named Pierre. See, French, suck my dick.
Okay, there it is. Damn it.
Who had been kicked out of his house trying to make him the husband of Princess Rosa. I don't know how that tracks
whatsoever.
Also,
why wouldn't you want to be the husband to a princess?
She's probably ugly.
I'd be absolute sugar baby mode. Yeah.
However, a devil named Lucifer, very on the nose.
Yeah, a devil named something creative, I don't know, Lucifer.
forced the princess to marry him and took her to his castle. Pero and Pierre went to the devil's castle and squared off with Lucifer. This work is filled with high quality humor, jokes, and ideas, and the passion of the staff.
Yeah, the real creative reach with naming your devil Lucifer. Cool.
Showcasing the possibilities of animation in those days, this work is one of the masterpieces of Toei Doga, predecessor of Toei Animation era, as well as being our commemorative work. Even now, 40 years after it's released, Pero is widely recognized and loved by fans and employees as a logo of our company. A few more just like random things that I found that were interesting, and then I'll also talk about some of the titles, but I'll just list them so it's not a big deal. The number of employees, I don't know what this means, but 840, quote-unquote, consolidated, or 559, quote-unquote, not consolidated.
What the fuck are you up to, Toei? What is your game here, man?
So what I'm thinking is they are not considering subsidiaries in the non-consolidated numbers. And then the consolidated, which has more, obviously.
Sure.
Has all of your 100% owned subsidiaries involved.
Okay. I'm into that. That makes sense.
It's like if I work for Apple, but I work for their China division.
Right. That, it's part of the, yeah.
Hang Hang Chonghua.
It can't be right. There's no way that's right.
It's not. They might not list me as an employee. Is the example that I'm trying to give you. So that data is as of March 2022. They're like up to date on this shit. Their operating capital, and this is a number I thought was really interesting, is 2.867 billion yen as of March 2022. That is $18,500,000.
Damn.
Operating capital. Yeah. So what that means is that is cash used for daily operations in any company. As a result, it is essential to the survival of each and every business, whether small or large, across industries and under any other conditions that a business faces. Lack of cash is one of the main reasons why a company fails. So, how you get that number is you take your current assets and you subtract your current liabilities. Liabilities include things like the buildings that you're constantly moving around to in all over Japan. It also is your employee salaries. It is pensions. It is all the things that are involved in, like, a liability is just like a debt that you owe as a company.
This is exactly how you, this is laundering 101, kids. Here you go.
No, this is running a business 101.
Right. Wink, right,
so
right.
So all I'm
okay,
trying to say is when you think a company is like super rolling in dough, I mean, $18.5 million liquid cash doesn't feel like a crazy amount.
Right.
Considering, like, I don't know how much an animation, like, run of episodes would cost, but that needs to pay for the buildings.
Right.
Like, any new things that they come up with, any licenses that they buy. Like, so I'm just trying to point out that the most successful studio potentially in Japan only has $18.5 million of funny money to play with.
That is tight. That is
think about,
right?
Like, think about we just talked about a company like Apple.
$3 trillion, baby.
But what they're
worth, but yeah,
right, their operating capital has to be in the billions.
Oh, for sure, easy.
And so it's just like a really interesting situation to like think about the scale. The biggest animations company potentially does not have anywhere near the operating income. I just wanted to find a more of a businessy approach here, because we've talked about a lot of times, like, why are they so broke?
Yeah, why right? Why are these,
like,
animation studios?
Why are you pushing
shit scenes and trash
shit
apps?
Scenes, yeah, shit shows.
Yeah,
shit employee situations.
Sometimes, like, in the immortal words of Lil Dicky on his freestyle in Sway in the Morning,
it hangs left.
What? Oh, just that it hangs left. Is that, you know, people think I'll be spazzing out, but I have to put a couple smashes out. Like, I just have to do a couple to pay the bills. I ain't forget about you. But, like, that's kind of what anime studios have to do as well. That they sometimes just have to push. They have to shit a couple out just to keep the lights on so they can actually work and make maybe some of the stuff that, like, they really want to make and put a lot of love elsewhere. So it's not like they don't want. Well, some studios maybe kind of get off on making trash. We know this to be true. But
I will say that was a really far left field poll, and I'm a fan of it.
You're the one who just went through literally the business logistics of Toei stock moves.
So what? In 2022, they had a ransomware attack, which I had never heard about.
Now, that's interesting. Fuck.
Yeah. An incident occurred in which an unauthorized third party attempted to hack Toei Animation's network, which resulted in the company's online store and internal systems, which we talked about in depth, are run on SAP.
So fucked
were,
up.
Were becoming temporarily suspended. The company investigated the incident and stated that the hack would affect the broadcast schedules of several anime series, including One Piece, in addition to Dragon Ball Super Superhero, was also rescheduled to June 11th, 2022. So, like, basically 3 whole months it moved back. On April 6, 2022, Toei Animation announced that it would resume broadcasting the anime series, including One Piece, the following day. The Japanese public broadcaster, NHK, reported that the hack was caused by a targeted ransomware attack. Now, they did not go into any details, unfortunately, as to who did it, why.
Oh no, we had to pay the ransom of $2 million and now $2 million are gone. Don't ask where it went.
Yeah, where could it have possibly gone?
They fucking staged that shit, dude.
So big titles that they worked on, of course, Cyborg 009, One Piece. We talked about Mazinger Z. I don't know what the fuck. It's just some robot anime. Slam Dunk, which I think is a classic. Saint Seiya.
That's a big one for a lot of people.
Dragon Ball.
Which one?
Yeah, I'd never heard of it.
Never heard of that one either? Yeah, okay.
Sally the Witch.
Okay, now that's a banger.
Galaxy Express 999?
Of course.
Sailor Moon?
Who?
Yeah, I'm done. Fuck it. But really interesting is all I can say.
They are anime.
Have you ever heard of the show Precure?
No.
There's 937 episodes of it, apparently.
Jesus Christ.
It is just below One Piece on their like discography, currently in production.
Wow.
Precure. Oh, it's Pretty Cure. They just... Oh, never heard of it?
Nope.
It's a magical girl anime. Never heard of this, but it's absolutely gangbusters, apparently.
Sounds like it.
Guess how much money this fucking IP has made in merchandise?
Half a billion yen?
Think, like, significantly more than that.
5 billion yen?
This has made 5.27 billion US fucking D.
Ooh,
between the,
what the
years
fuck?
Of 2005 and 2013.
Jesus Christ.
And another $2.8 billion USD, boy.
Wow.
Between 2014 and 2020. For a grand fucking total of $8 billion.
Holy shit.
What a cash mother effing cow, boy.
Wow. That's the good one.
And that's
right
the
there.
Stuff you wouldn't have heard about if you didn't go through my entire timeline of Toei. So you can continue. I'm really sorry.
I will start over because I'm going to edit that out.
What?
What do you mean what? I'm debating editing out 25 minutes of like, look, we're okay. You want to not edit shit out? We're at an hour 7 uh-huh. and 30 minutes of it was you going over the fucking logistical backbone that is SAP.
Incredible.
Oh my God. Okay. So, as I was saying, started with an anime studio that radiates positivity, and they had overcome this tragedy and adversity to bounce back better than ever. The next studio I'm going to talk about seems to invite it, invite adversity, invite fucking crime, and they may be a mainstay in the anime community, producing probably some of the greatest classics that a lot of people around the world consider to be as such. But I consider this studio kind of be a group of shitheads a little bit. So it kind of starts in the early 1980s where 7 college first years in Osaka got together to form a little group called Daikon Films, a fledgling studio dedicated not to anime specifically, but nerd culture, being inspired by Godzilla, Star Wars, and things like Super Sentai and stuff like that. Their first were animated. Their first stuff was like animated shorts used to promote kind at a Japanese sci-fi convention called Nihon SF Taikai, and they were doing like kind of parody spins, shit you'd see on like Newgrounds and YouTube, but like a little bit more polished, I'd assume. I'd hope.
It's like the beginning of college humor.
Like the animated shit, like Dorkly.
Yeah.
Kind of like Dorkly, right? So they're doing spins on like Kaiketsu
or Trogdor.
Or absolutely Homestar Runner. Yes, yes. Like Kaiketsu Zubat and Super Sentai are like Power Ranger inspirations. And they were doing like parodies of that shit. So they're basically known for being like witty and irreverent and kind of shit like that. They had this one show that I kind of found that was really fucking hilarious. It's kind of a parody on a Power Ranger type show called Aikoku Sentai Dai Nippon. And it had like, I don't know how to put this, but I'll put it what I typed. It used footage from actual Super Sentai series to make an absurdist commentary about the Russo-Japanese War. And the heroes who were named things like Geisha and Tempura fought to stop the evil quote-unquote death Kremlin from brainwashing the children of Japan into becoming communists. It was very off the wall, but you can see how this, maybe as you make sense, the studio started to gain a bit of a postmodern slant that would become their signature. Daikon Films changed its name in 1985 to use an obscure word for giant and adding an X to make it sound cool and multicultural. That's right, I'm talking about Gainax. This, I'm being very specific here because in our Discord, I got clowned on for pronouncing this wrong a bunch. So to you all, I'm putting a lot of care into this, okay? So the rest of the history of Gygax continues like this. so shitty. So basically, they started doing like bigger, they had their first debut film, Royal Space Force, The Wings of Hanamis, whatever. It's a space opera. As well as like they had an OVA Gunbuster, which popped off like crazy in 88. They got those two things alone, got them enough critical and financial clock, like acclaim and clout to put Gygax on like the actual like center stage. Right?
Put it on the map.
Put it on the freaking map. So after they had these two successes.
So buybacks. Well,
yeah. So Gary Gygax himself, they found their golden goose, right? In the like late 80s, early 90s, they were doing OVAs and shit. But then right. They found their big boy, Neon Genesis Evangelion. So I didn't say the names of the seven individuals because I don't think they're all important, but they will be as they become so, and I'll let you know which ones. One of them is Hideki Anno, who is the one of the original seven. He created and directed this now legendary deconstruction of Mecha, which shocked and captivated the world around. It was obviously completely like was mature and like really got incredibly psychological. And it remains Gygax's like most like awesome property to this day. A lot of people consider it. However, it wasn't all rosy. Anno was suffering from a 4-year-long mental spiral depression after working on one of their originals, The Secret of Blue Water. Nadia, I think, is the real name.
Do you think it's possible that this all happened because he couldn't figure out what his name was all the whole time?
Maybe.
Like, their company kept changing their name, and then that was really an issue. I think it might be because they didn't integrate with SAP.
They didn't. They used fucking Maximo, like, those right. noobs that they are. Yeah, so Gygax, like, basically had this guy.
Geronimix
had this guy, Anno, who, a genius to most, but he was spiraling out of control and depression. And he worked on that so hard in a failed sequel to Royal Space Force, that space opera, his shaky state of mind kind of, and he ended up changing the ending from an angel fight in space to a deep, almost unusually so, psychoanalysis of the main characters. This decision gave Neon Genesis Evangelion the dubious honor of being one of the first Gygax endings. This one I'll get, you know, fuck it, get this right. The Gynax ending. It's basically the series finale that comes out of fucking nowhere and sinks little context and like sense in the context of the show. This is where it started. And it started because it's like kind of a sad story. This guy who started going fucking insane because he worked so hard on something that did succeed and then so hard on something that failed that he just completely went insane and just made a complete insane pivot and did not stick the landing very well to Evangelion. So, so his odd behavior, as well as their tight budget and production schedule, made other like higher ups in the Gigagax high ups like very nervous that there wouldn't be enough money to stay afloat.
Mm-hmm.
So when I don't know why you're giggling so much. When Evangelion
Glax,
Glax turned out to be an unprecedented cash cow, they hid most of the profits from the government. And this is where we get to our first crime. So the Jijix president, Takehisi Sawamura, and the tax accountant that they had at the time were arrested in July 1999 for withholding. They concealed $1.56 billion worth of income.
I was going to say, holy shit.
Yeah, and they basically committed tax fraud of 560 million yen. They had basically the grand majority of their earnings from Evangelion, and they basically paid other weird large fees and stuff, but they withdrew like 90% of the sums from other companies' account as cash, and they stored it all in safe deposit boxes. Literally, they were storing over a billion yen in just metal fucking boxes, which is wild.
Yeah, so very odd.
Yeah.
A billion yen is like a million yen.
Yes.
Or dollars,
but in terms of just sheer mass.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a better way to launder money. I'm not trying to give people ideas, but that can't be the best way.
It absolutely isn't the best way, because they got fucking caught, and both of them went to jail for tax fraud, and accounting fraud. So they later basically, Yasuhiro Takeda later defended, which I think was one of the originals, defended Salamora's actions as being a reaction to Gigagagagax perpetually precarious financial situation, and basically said that, like, basically their excuse was, like, the money was rolling in so fast, we didn't know where to put it all. Deadass, that's what he said. Yeah,
I don't know your taxes, you fucking
right?
Dick.
Quote, unquote, I guess he was vulnerable to temptation at that point. Because no one knew how long the Evangelion golden goose would keep laying their golden eggs.
Forever.
Forever. Turns out forever.
Still laying it.
Yeah. Still laying, dude. Still laying. But it kind of propelled them. Like, after they got over the rockiness and the reshuffling of the higher-ups, they started to create some really amazing stuff. So Jinjax basically started producing stuff like Fooly Cooly. Amazing. We love Fooly Cooly.
Great.
Yeah.
It's my favorite gray goose.
Is your favorite Grey Goose?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Great flavor. There's one called This Ugly Yet Beautiful World in 2004. It was one of their less serious ventures, but Binbacks, basically, they focused on a relationship between an orphan and a mysterious little girl who fell from the sky, blah, blah, blah. It's like Evangelion, but like nowhere near as depressing.
Thank God. I have obviously always had the really aggressive take that it's like super overrated.
I think it is solid, but it is overrated, in my opinion.
It's just like Bibimbap didn't even try to make it work at the end, you know?
Bibimbap?
Yep, yeah.
They didn't make that work?
Bibimbap.
Yeah. Yeah. So they kind of bounced back in 2007 with Gelatinous's new big hitter, Gurren Lagann.
Gelatinous?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're called. I don't
right.
know. What did you hear? I said Gainax. What did you say?
I heard Cousin Gary.
You heard Cousin Gary?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So Gregarious kind of really full-scented
oh
with
God,
with Gurren Lagann. And I love Gurren Lagann. Patbot sucks Gurren Lagann's dong.
Yeah, I can't even. I've never finished it.
Dude.
I've tried so many times. It's just so fucking
boring. It's going to click one day for you, and you're going to be like, that's my fault.
Be like that.
That's my fault. It did. But the one that I find that was kind of interesting, I didn't even know this show existed. 2010. Panty and Stocking with Garter Belt.
Yeah, you never heard of this?
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, shit, I've never heard of it. So it turns out that this was spawned from the brains of, like, the drunk Gelatinous's employees who were chatting about Western cartoons, like, Drawn Together. And right after Gurren Lagann wrapped up, they came up with the show that two angels named Panty and Stocking use their holy power to transform their underwear into weapons and keeps Datton City safe from harm. One love sex. One love sweets, blah, 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 blah. Fan service and toilet humor all around. So, I mean, it's kind of like one of the biggest parody of their own cliches, which is amazing. So, I mean,
what did it really mention drawn together in that little sentence?
Yes.
That's so interesting.
Yes, they were literally talking about, like, after they finished Gurren Lagann, like, okay, how does Geiger kind of bring that same adult energy to their shows, right? Like, with, like, drawn together and stuff like that.
Right.
So, you know, Giganto kind of came up with Panty and Stocking with Garner Belt. So, that's what they wanted to bring. So, I found that to be pretty cool. But there was, blah, 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 there was some splitting at this point here in a bit.
Any stock splits that we should know about?
No. Oh, well, okay. There is one that is a bit of note.
Oh, damn. I was really hoping for a 3-for-1 stock split.
Somehow, I kind of figured you would. So, one of the same guy before, the Hideki Anno, he split off at some point right after Evangelion to work on Studio Kara, basically, and start his own company, kind of like the classic tale of, like, I'm going to do my own thing. I want more freedom. And then...
You're right, exactly.
That's... Well, given his potential mental, you know, health issue history...
Oh, wait, that guy? Same guy?
That's the same guy. He's
the guy who ruined Evangelion.
Yeah, he split off in 2006 to do a bunch of his rebuild of Evangelion films with Studio Kara. So... Crime number two, he came back and tried to sue Gigamo for 100 million yen in unpaid royalties for an agreement that he would continue and his company would continue to earn royalties for the work he did on Evangelion. So they never paid that shit.
100 million
yen.
Okay.
Yeah. This is all in yen.
This is starting to get like astronomical amounts of money that Evangelion made.
This is like Rhea amounts of suing cash right now. But no, it was reported that, you know,
true, Rhea.
Honestly, yeah, that the court.
I hope you die, Rhea.
The court decided, yeah, pay all your shit to them. But they have said that Anno has come out and basically said that the original company never personally apologized to him or gave him an explanation as to why they didn't pay up in the first place. So I think it's just that he should know better because he was around when tax fraud. I don't know why it's a shock to him.
I would also say they probably do not have that money liquid anymore.
Oh, no.
Right?
No.
So, like, what does he expect?
We're about to get to that. So, in 2011, one of the OGs, Hiroyuki Amishi, left, I don't know how to pronounce this. It sounds weird. Gainax.
Left Gainax.
Yeah. So, I know I got that one right. Left Gainax to form Studio Trigger, actually, and along with some of the key members. This happened kind of right after the finishing of Gurren Lagann, and they went off and made shit like Kill la Kill, which was, quote-unquote, the anime that was going to save anime. yeah, and that kind of shows a lot of the key staff members from the OG Gainax came over to Studio Trigger. So you kind of saw that in Darling in the Franxx. They co-produced that Darling in the Franxx with A1, where they had that crazy ending too. It felt very similar to Evangelion, but that was planned, but it had that fingerprint all over it. So at this point, they kind of fizzle out and they stopped doing originals and they started adapting existing manga and visual novels. And their most recent work hasn't really been of note, I would say. I mean, the last thing they really did was in 2015, and that's the last thing that they did that they can, like, put their name on. Like, you had others earlier on that, Madoka Box, you had Stella Woman's Academy, Magical Wars, Wish Upon the Pleiades.
So what was their timeline? They started in what year and then ended in what year?
So... they officially started in 1985 when they officially formed as GoGo.
Okay.
And they started making real stuff, started with Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water in 1990. The last true thing that they did.
Isn't that so weird? Every studio, like, they start in, like, 85, and then 5 years later, they put out their first thing.
Right. And they were, because that was, like, they were just kind of putzing around making shorts and stuff like that.
So when did GoGurt end?
GoGurt ended. I don't think they officially haven't really ended, but they're
just not like leading the front anymore.
They're not leading the front. So basically they were bought out by another holding company, but the running director, the representative director of that company, Tomohiro Maki, in December of 2019, was arrested on allegations of, this is how they word it, quasi-forcible indecency on an aspiring voice actress. Whoo! This isn't even Gingix anymore. This is like the holding company for Gingo. And
yeah,
like,
I mean, it sounds like Jinsing is really covering something up there.
I they really are. I mean, at this point, Jenga's survived like four or five like straight up right. like actual crimes. This guy went to 2.5 years in prison for committing indecent acts in 2020. And this is the last we really have. I mean, like, their last work they put out was in 2015. So,
and that was?
That was Wish Upon the Pleiades.
Oh, right.
Which, Magical Girls, what do you want?
They're wishing upon stars, of course.
Yeah, their latest work was Masane Danticle, was in 2018. And that was really it. I mean, it's funny because like while they have produced some of the shit that has been the most off-the-wall stuff, I honestly think like Gynax, who, you know, I pronounced it right the entire time. I don't want to hear anything in the Discord on that.
Right. Yeah, and we put so much effort into doing it right the whole time.
You know, we talked about it off mic, how much like it really mattered to get that kind of thing right. And we do it for y'all. We do it for y'all. But thank you for coming to class. If you'd like to discuss anything we've talked about today, please come into the Discord. Patreon.com/Ubology. $1 and up gets you into that Discord with all the lovely Patreon guests and the folks that are in there. And you can shit on Ethan about how he decided to give you an econ lesson when I wanted to talk about anime studios.
I've actually decided that all of my episodes are going to be econ lessons from now on.
Econ with E.
Yeah.
And if you would like to, you know, give us a shout, or you want to check out a little bit of our merch, Weebology.com. There's a link tree there to everywhere you can contact us. It has a form. You can email us directly and just say hi and tell us to watch an anime. And the merch looks sick. It looks really sick. Did I mention it looks sick? Because it looks super sick. Like, comment, subscribe, anywhere we do that. 5 stars and reviews would be incredibly helpful. And guys, I know you're on a platform. Peaceful Rick is still here in the building. It's holiday season. I'm feeling merry. I'm feeling cheerful. So go in there. It's 2 clicks over and down. Over 204 episodes. Or I forgot the number.
33, I believe.
Over 200 hours of content about anime, current classic,
that's
and
a
everything
guarantee.
Between. That's an absolute platy guarantee. But I think that is it. I'm going to go, crunch some fucking numbers. That's what we're doing
yeah,
today.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah, but I want to do a little bit more research on Geyser. It's a really interesting studio background.
Gizzards are just like such an interesting... I think maybe we should just do an entire episode on Evangelion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Gigahoo is definitely going to be like, there's more to talk about with that studio.
Gigantor was a good guy.
Yeah, great guy. But until we piss everyone off with wonderful pronunciations of Gynax, I'm Ricky.
And I'm Gorfian.
And this has been Weebology.
Deuces.
We're going to lose everyone at minute fucking 40. Just off the rails.
You should stick it out, guys.